So I first just want to begin by thanking all of you who made my residency possible. I really appreciate it. The folks on the board and the different committees, I never can understand the different committees, but those of you who support the Sangha and on those committees, I really appreciate that. And Tiska, thank you very much for doing what you did, and especially to Andrea and Todd, too. They've been putting me up, and it's been... They've actually been spoiling me, so it's been fantastic.
Good.
Yes. So as Andrea mentioned, I'm going to be speaking about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and yet another list. This list is called the Five Aggregates. Again, I just want to give just a little bit of background, so I want to make sure that all of us are on the same page in case you haven't been coming to these talks on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Very briefly, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness are these four areas that the Buddha encouraged us to be mindful of. And last week I gave a talk on the Fourth Foundation of Mindfulness, this first list called the Five Hindrances. The Fourth Foundation of Mindfulness really is... You could say it's these different lists, which are categories of experience or categories of phenomena that we can work with, that we can utilize. And when we work with these various lists, it really helps to refine our mindfulness. It really sharpens it. And when the mindfulness is sharpened like that, then the heart begins to be liberated. The heart and mind begin to free themselves. There's a freedom that arises from that. In small ways and in big ways. So tonight is this list called the Five Aggregates. And it's a teaching that's intimately intertwined with this insight in the not-self. And the insight in the not-self that the Buddha talks about, or is talked about in Buddhism, is really foundational for this path. It's really one of the most profound and transformative insights that occur on this path. And this teaching on not self is very often misunderstood and confused. So tonight I'm going to be speaking about the five aggregates, but also this insight into not self, because they're really intertwined. Because working with the five aggregates really leads to this visceral experience of an insight into not self. Another way of understanding just of what the five aggregates are doing and how it interplays with the insight into not self, and I'll be explaining this in more and more detail, is that when we use this teaching of the five aggregates, what it's doing is it's as if it's deconstructing our sense of self. We all have a sense of self, which I'll be talking about, and it deconstructs it in a way that allows us to be free of this sense of self that really hinders us, that really... allows suffering to arise. And this is what we're going to understand tonight, I hope, on some level at least. When I first heard the teachings on the five aggregates, actually I just thought it was just another weird Buddhist list that I couldn't relate to. I really couldn't relate to it. And the first time I really related to it was when I started to do some retreats with this teacher, Shinzen Young. Has anybody ever done a retreat with Shinzen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's a very creative and innovative kind of guy. And I really appreciated how he spoke about the five aggregates, and he actually developed a way of meditating in the spirit of this teaching. And it was really wonderful because he kind of simplified it. And his simplified version really gave me a feel of the power of this teaching of the five aggregates. Because he was speaking about how revolutionary this teaching was of the Buddha. This teaching in particular is very revolutionary. And I felt like his innovation really brought that out. So I could really get a taste of, wow, the power of this teaching and where it leads. And I appreciated how he talked about it. He would compare it to... kind of this phrase that you find from the Roman Empire. So when the Romans were trouncing about conquering as much of the world as they could, they had a phrase that they would use, or an idea that they would use to conquer their enemies, and it was this idea of divide and conquer. And so the idea behind that is when they went into battle with their enemy, the first thing that they would do is actually that they would divide the enemy up. So it wasn't trying to dominate first, it was actually dividing up the enemy in different pockets, and then they would conquer. And they found that that was extremely effective. And in the same way with the five aggregates, we're doing a similar process. We're dividing up experience. Not so much to conquer, but to see clearly. Because once it's divided up, it's much easier to get an understanding of how this sense of self arises or where it lands, and to cut through it, to really see clearly. So it's this process of dividing. And this teaching on the five aggregates really is at the heart of the way that the Buddha's teaching. There is a Pali scholar by the name of Richard Gombrich who says that it must be at the center of the Buddhist teaching, because the teaching on the five aggregates is so ubiquitous, it happens so frequently in the Pali canon, that it really must be at the heart of it, because the Buddha is constantly talking about the five aggregates, and we find this in the Pali canon. So it's very important. And I want to share with you a description of awakening that the Buddha probably used. It's something from the Dhammapada that relates to this idea of dividing up our experience in these five different ways. And I'll be going into the specifics of this. He says, "House builder, you're seeing. You will not build a house again. All your rafters broken, the ridge pole dismantled, immersed in dismantling, the mind has attained awakening." So I don't know if you hear this in this metaphor. So we have this metaphor of this house with the rafters and the ridgepole. Making up our sense of self. We have this feeling of a sense of self. And what happens with this practice is that gets dismantled. And once that's dismantled, the heart becomes free. And it's also a teaching that many times what you'll find in the Pali Canon is a teaching that's very much connected with these experiences of awakening. So many times the Buddha's giving a discourse on the five aggregates, the monks or the practitioners practice it, and then there's a full awakening that happens. So it's really directly connected with liberation. Small taste of liberation and the big stuff. So I first want to talk about this insight into not-self before I get into the five aggregates, so that we have kind of a basis of it. And the way I'd like to begin is just to tell a little bit of a story of someone who really had a deep experience of this. And it's actually a person from a different tradition, because I really want to point out that this experience of not-self, it's not like Buddhism has the market cornered on not-self. It's really the spiritual experience that you can find in other traditions. I think what the Buddha really contributed was a very clear path towards that. And so I would just want to share with you a little bit about this woman, Bernadette Roberts. Has anyone ever heard of Bernadette Roberts? She was a Catholic nun for 9 years. She was actually cloistered for 9 years. And during that time, she actually had some very deep spiritual experiences, but it wasn't this experience of not-self yet. So she was cloistered for 9 years, and then she left being a nun, and then for 20 years, she just lived a regular householder life. And she said that was really when her spiritual practice really deepened. So she got married, she had kids, she had a job, she was living the daily life. And then out of the blue, 20 years after, she'd been cloistered, she had this very deep experience of not-self, of the sense of self completely dropping away. And I think for many people, what happens is there's a little taste of the sense of self dropping away, and then it comes back. And a lot of times that's how the meditation progresses. But for her, it was very dramatic. And so I want to share with you just a little bit about that. The way she described it, just very simply, was, I realized I no longer had a within at all. Within in quotations. I realized I no longer had a within at all. And I want to share with you a metaphor that will help explain this a little bit more deeply. So she used the analogy, she gives the analogy of a balloon to describe this process. Us being, you know, me sitting here, or you sitting there, we're like this balloon. That's our experience. So I exist within this balloon. So my sense of self is within this balloon. It's kind of generally, in a non-meditative way, I have this sense of self here. This is balloon that I call me or mine, or I call it I. Here I am. And then we have the world out there. And that's our normal experience, right? I'm sitting here and I see all of you out there. Or you're sitting there and you see me out here. And the center of your experience is right there, within that metaphorical balloon. And what she said happened was, one day that balloon just popped. So there was no more center of experience, a self experiencing that which is out there. So it was a radically different orientation to the world. And she describes it, actually she distinguishes it from other meditative experiences or other spiritual experiences. Because when she was a nun, she actually had a very deep spiritual experience where she described that she was the balloon and the air in there was, that was her, and then the air out there was not her. But then she started to live in this way where she started to realize that the air inside the balloon, metaphorically, me, is the same air that's out there. So it's this deep experience of oneness. Okay? The air that's in here, the quality of presence that's in here is the same that's out there. It's just the spiritual experience of oneness. But there's still a balloon. There's still this sense of self. It might be a sense of self that feels divine, but it's still a sense of self. And then it was only later for her that that balloon popped. And she talks about it in terms of this experience of not self. And she actually relates it to this teaching on the five aggregates. She said she was in a nun, and so she was reading a lot of Christian mysticism, and she could read a lot of experiences about this union with God, this experience of oneness. But she couldn't find anything about this not self. So she had to look outside of her tradition a little bit. So that's one example of this experience of not self. And again, you know, some of you who have meditated might have had a small glimpses of this, where it's just, you know, a thought coming and going, or a sensation arising and passing away. Or sometimes people talk about it, instead of breathing, I'm breathing, it's just the body breathing, or being breathed, or being walked. This is, you know, sometimes these small glimpses of it. So one description of this not-self quality. And please keep in mind, this is just a description, and language is very difficult here, because I'm using a language that presupposes that there's a subject at the center of experience. So whatever I say is going to be inaccurate. Not only that, I'm not the Buddha, so you get it. It's not going to be exact either. But with the metaphor of the balloon, I'm hoping that you'll get the sense of non-separation. Do you get that? And this intimacy, this real intimacy with the world that she's living in. That's the quality of liberation that we're talking about. That quality of intimacy. That quality of non-separation. So I want to spend a little time just clarifying this teaching in terms of the way the Buddha taught it on not self. Just to make sure we're all on the same page of that before going into the five aggregates. And I want to start with a story. It's a story about this fellow Vajragota who did have a habit of asking the Buddha all kinds of questions. And one day Vajragota went up to the Buddha, and Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, was there as well. And he asked the Buddha, "So, Venerable Sir, is there a self?" And the Buddha was silent. So Vajragota said, well, then, is there not a self?" And once again, the Buddha was silent. And that was the end of that conversation. Vajragota got up and left. And then Ananda turned to the Buddha and says, "What's up with that? What's up with the silence? Why don't you give me a little clearer answer there?" And the Buddha said to Ananda, "Well, basically, if I would have told him that there was a self, or if I would have told him that there was not a self, I would have been giving him a wrong view. I would have been leading him down the wrong path." This is very important for us to understand this. So telling him that there is a self or telling him there's not a self is the wrong way. This is not what this teaching on not self is about. And I'll explain it more clearly here. So it's not the question of do I exist or do I not exist. This teaching on not self is actually not about figuring out if there is a self or if there's not a self. It's more examining experience and noticing that any experience that is arising, there's nothing in it that we can call me, mine, or I. So it's this functional quality to it. I'm just looking at experience and I'm noticing, is there anything that I can call me, mine, or I? But I'm not making a philosophical position on it, of if there is a self or if there's not a self. And again, the Buddha is very clear about this. He talks about inappropriate attention. You know, we can attend appropriately to the moment, or we can attend inappropriately. And these are some of the questions that would arise from attending inappropriately. So he says, this is how the practitioner attends inappropriately, with these questions. Was I in the past, or was I not in the past? Was there a self in the past, or was there not a self in the past? Or else, the practitioner is inwardly perplexed about the immediate present by asking questions like, am I or am I not? What am I? How am I? It's all these kind of philosophical questions about self. And then he goes on to explain that he wants to prevent either the view of having a self or not having a self entering into a practitioner's mind. So what we're dealing with more here is not, again, a philosophical position. It's more the sense of self that we get from our experience. But we're not going to get philosophical about this. Because what the Buddha says we should appropriately be attending to is suffering and the end of suffering. Not in philosophy, but what's going to lead to the end of suffering? And how does suffering arise? Seeing the dynamic of suffering. Seeing the dynamic of suffering in a way that leads to our liberation. And what the Buddha is saying is that where suffering is arising is when we take some part of our experience and we call it me, mine, or I. That's all he's interested in. Is this making sense, this distinction between a philosophical endeavor and a practical endeavor that leads to the end of suffering? Let me just give a concrete example of this, of how this me, mine, or I is connected with suffering, and I don't have to get into a philosophical position about it. This example that some of you might have heard before, I use it often. When I was living in Silver City, New Mexico, I got this car. It was a great car. I got it for $250. It was a Daihatsu Charade. It was a three-cylinder engine. But you can imagine the condition it was in if I bought it for $250. So I remember getting it, and probably 6 months or a year later, it had these electric windows. And these electric windows kept on breaking. And each time the electric window would go out, I would have this feeling of, I can't believe this is happening. What's up with this? And then I have to rewire it, and then it would happen again. And I suffered a lot over that car. And you would think that I would know better. And actually, if it was your car, I could empathize with you, but I'm not going to be suffering greatly over it, right? And why is that? It's because it's not my car. And why was I suffering around it? Because it was my car. And so I'd come to identify with it. And as a result of identifying with it, and not only identifying it, thinking that it should stay the same, I suffered. And I'm sure you noticed this, right? You know, something in your experience that you call me or mine, and something happens to it, you suffer. Your friend's car breaks down, you can empathize with them. You can show them why they're suffering because they're grasping onto the sense of self. But you don't feel it as much, right? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So that's why the sense of self, and I'm not, it's not getting philosophical about the self, it's just noticing how my mind identifies with certain experiences. And as a result of this identification process, there's suffering. So that means, once this mind let go of that identification process, then that suffering ceases. Is this making sense? Good. So this is this teaching on not self. And it is something that gets confused a lot, because later on in Buddhism it starts to become a philosophical position. But then we lose the meat of this practice, of just noticing this dynamic. Okay, so the five aggregates, they're the list of these five areas, or literally these five heaps of experience that we tend to identify with. Yeah, the Pali word is khanda, which means heap or pile, and it's just this division of our experience. It's usually connected with this word upadana, which means clinging. So it's these five areas of experience that we cling to, and the way we cling to it is by creating or believing in the sense of self. This term upadana khanda also is related to actually the fuel for fire. So when we let go of these, we extinguish this fire of suffering. So I want to go through these and show how we... And it's a wonderful list, because the Buddha really hits these areas that we have a tendency to identify with, that we really have a sense of self around. And again, it's going to be deconstructing this sense of self that leads to liberation. Before I get into this, I do want to, this is kind of a caveat, but I do want to point out, so we're going in this direction where we're going beyond our sense of self, beyond the sense of self. We're allowing it to deconstruct. We're going to pop the balloon. Before that happens, one thing that is so important that can be ignored in spiritual practices is, before we let go of a sense of self, we actually have to have a strong sense of self. It's really important. So that balloon has to actually get thick and really there and really present for a strong sense of self to be there before we go beyond that. It might sound paradoxical, but I've noticed it again and again how important that is. And so what I mean by sense of self, it's like having clear boundaries. Being a very clear boundaried person is going to allow us to go beyond this sense of self. But that needs to happen first. And it often gets ignored. So let's go into these different areas, and then I want to give you examples of, and I want to make sure that you understand how we really do have a sense of self here. So as I go through this list, first, I want you to consider these in terms of a very non-meditative mind. So not so much of just our ordinary sense of things. So I'm not going to be asking trick questions or anything, but just so you understand this sense of self, so that we understand what we're going beyond. So the first aggregate, or this first pile that the Buddha talks about, is this aggregate of form, rupa, or body. It's actually also referred to as one of the four foundations of mindfulness, right? The first foundation of mindfulness. And it's a place that we really have this sense of self, right? Like if you imagine, if I were to stand up right now, or if you were to stand up right now, you'd have this sense that I'm standing up. And you're at the center of that experience, right? Or when you're sitting down here, you're at the center of that experience. Or maybe some of you were like me during the sit tonight, there was coldness. And there was a sense of, I was cold. Were you cold? I was cold. So what's at the center of that is not only language, but the sense of, I'm cold. I'm the one that's cold. I'm the one that's standing up. I'm the one that's sitting down. That's this sense of self that's intertwined into this first area of body. Right? Does everybody have a sense of that? There's a sense of self there? It actually covers all the five senses, not the, you know, there's six senses in Buddhist psychology, the sixth sense being the mind, but all five senses are covered in this first aggregate. So again, there's that sense of self there. The other pile or heap that we also have a sense of self is, again, it's one of these foundations of mindfulness around vedana, or feeling. So I'm at the center of an unpleasant experience or a pleasant experience. When I eat chocolate, it's pleasant. It's pleasant for me. When I took out, before I came to Albuquerque, there was a container of pinto beans that I made in the back of the refrigerator. So I pulled them out and I made the mistake of seeing if they were bad. They were nasty. Nasty, translating that into Vedana, is unpleasant. Right? It was unpleasant for me. It was nasty for me. I was the one experiencing that. Right? So again, that's another place where we can find this strong sense of self. And you might notice, as I go through these, we're going to be getting into more subtle and subtle aspects of experience. And in some ways, a stronger sense of self as we go through this too. The next area that the Buddha talks about is perception. Perception is the best way to understand it is as an activity. It's this naming activity. You know, the example that's usually given is the mind being able to say, oh, that's blue. Oh, that's green. That's red. Okay, so it sees, as the activity is seen, and then there's a small label put on that on what we're seeing, on the experience of seeing. That's this activity of perception. So I name things. So it's that naming quality. Blue, red. Oh, there's the bell outside. Bell. That's perception. And here again, there's a sense of self. I'm the one that's seeing blue. I'm the one that's hearing the bell. I'm the one that's actually naming the world. Especially with our educational system, we really learn that I am the one that names. Again, there's a sense of self there. And then the next one is sankhara, which is usually translated as mental formations. The way this is defined actually changes as Buddhism grows. In the Pali canon, a lot of people believe that mental formations really centered around just this one activity of volition. And I think this really fits with our sense of self. So volition being the doing quality, right? This is where it gets even trickier. I feel like I'm doing something. I have the intention to meditate. And how can it be that there's nobody behind this intention to meditate? I must be the one there. You have that sense, right? that in there, there's again the sense of self. And then the fifth one, which again happens often in meditation, is to start to identify with this aspect of experience, and that's consciousness. It's that aspect of our experience that is aware. I am the one that is aware. I am the observer. Right? Have you noticed that experience even in meditation? Where we can see sensations come and go, a sound come and go, a thought arise and pass away. But I am the one that's noticing it. See how that can be the most subtle sense of self? And it's that subtle sense of self that also gives a continuity to this feeling of, I'm here. So, do you see how you identify with all these different aspects of your experience? There's an identification with that? Right? Clear? And you might notice how it confines you. You know, we have that this identifying with experience confines us. You know, there's the general labels that we have. I'm a teacher, I'm a lawyer, I'm a businessman, you know, I'm a doctor. And for any of you that have changed a job, if you've noticed what that's like to, everybody sees you as a teacher, and then all of a sudden you lose that job, and then you can have this feeling of being with that identity. And wow, you can feel it. It's visceral. It's like a loss. Has anyone ever gone through that? Or I'm a wife or a husband, and then all this, or a mother, and then all of a sudden that identity is lost there. And what's happening is that suffering around the confinement around that. Or it's a sense that we have of ourselves of, I'm a horrible person. And then all of a sudden, that's confining, right? And we can never be any other kind of person. A lot of times we carry those kind of identities with us. I'm no good. Something's wrong with me. These are identities that we carry around. But again, that cause this suffering. It can be the opposite too. I'm such a kind person. I'm a great person. It's confining. We do it to ourselves and we do it to others. And as a result of that, we end up disconnected also. There's not that intimacy that you hear in that description of Bernadette Roberts' experience of not-self. It's confining. So there's suffering intertwined with us. It not only happens on the individual level, it happens on the collective level. How does so much of the suffering happen? Us and them. Nationalism. Right? That's where there's an identity. There's now a collective identity that needs to be protected. And it needs to be protected from those other identities out there, them. Right? So it happens, this kind of suffering happens on the individual level and it happens on the collective level. And both we need to address. I also want to point out, just on the collective level, there's also a, just like I said, that we have to build a strong sense of self before we go beyond it. It's the same on the collective level. A lot of times we need to cultivate some kind of collective identity within ourselves and then go beyond it. It's really important in terms of like racial identity. When they've done racial identity development studies. I don't know if anybody's studied Janet Helms about racial identity development. Just in the sense of a lot of times, this is she did this whole thing about racial identity development for whites, which is different because whites have a privilege of not thinking about race. So there's always this, for whites it's beginning with this cluelessness about any kind of differentiation. Oh, and then there's a realization, oh, that race matters. And then it's starting to realize that one has a cultural identity. And then there can start to be an engagement on a different level about issues of race. So it's like, you know, beginning that, whites usually have this balloon that's very weak. There's not a clear boundary. as a result of that, tremendous harm happens. So just like on the individual level, on the collective level, we create that, and then we refine that, and then we go beyond it. So how do we break through this sense of self? And the Buddha is very clear about this in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. First, you recognize what's arising, and you see it for what it is. You notice that it arises and passes away. Because if it's something that arises and passes away, then it can't be a fixed self, right? It's impermanent. So with body, we see that a sensation arises and it passes away. There's nothing in there I can call me, mine, or I. Even a perception, I'm watching the abdomen rise and fall, and maybe I use the label rising. That's a perception. It's just a perception that arises and passes away. There's nothing me or mine or anything about that in there. Or doing. Oh, intention. There's an intention in the mind, and then an action happens. We can see that in the meditation. That can be very liberating. You start to go beyond the sense of self. Or with awareness. Noticing that there's a sound and there's awareness of it. And then that passes away. The more we see small glimpses of this, the more it begins to erode this sense of self. It begins to pop this balloon. And then we start to experience a different kind of intimacy in our lives. Another thing I want to say about this process that can happen, especially if you start to get deeper and deeper into meditation, is that it can actually be scary. Because what we're doing is that if you think about it, your life really revolves around some sense of self. It's the ground we stand on. And usually when we get grounded again, when I notice when people are feeling ungrounded and they get grounded again, usually they're getting grounded in a sense of self. It's great. It's really important. Because taking away that sense of self really leaves this feeling of groundlessness. There is no ground to stand on. And a lot of this practice is getting to this point where we're comfortable living a life that is groundless, this quality of groundlessness. Actually, I think this happened to Bernadette Roberts after she had this experience. It was, in one sense, too intense. She couldn't go out and get groceries for her kids for a few days. It was such a reorganization of her system that functioning was not happening for a little while until she started getting used to that groundlessness. So sometimes when we feel that groundlessness, when we have a loss of some of these identities, it's to really start to sense into that, to see if we can get used to that. I actually just want to start with a story. I didn't bring the sutta, so I'm going to see if I can remember it. Just to give a sense of, in one way, how simple this practice of the five aggregates is and how powerful it is. The simplicity of what we're doing and the power of it. And it's about this practitioner whose name was Bahia of the bark cloth. And he, at the time, I think, was living in southern India. And he actually thought he was enlightened. So he was sitting there thinking how great it was to be enlightened. And this celestial being came up, who I guess it was an old relative of his, and kind of sat on his shoulder and said, "Bahia, I got some bad news." "Not only you're awake, but you're on the wrong path, buddy." So Bahia was an ardent practitioner, though. So he said, "Well, what's a path that can really lead me to awakening?" And this celestial being said, "Well, there's this guy, the Buddha, in northern India, and I'm sure he can show you the way." So Bahia got up from his seat right then and just started walking north. So this is a long walk. No trains at that time. He walked and walked and walked until he came into the village where the Buddha was going around for alms rounds. And he said to the Buddha, "Please teach me the path to awakening." And the Buddha said, "Bahia, I'm wondering if I can wait. I'm on my alms round right now. And of alms round, I'll eat lunch, get back, and then after that, I'll give you a teaching." And Bahia said, "Uh-uh. I don't know when I'm going to die, and I don't know when you're going to die. I need it now." And I think the Buddha said, probably politely, "Later, Bahia." But Bahia asked a third time. This is important if you ever run across the Buddha. Always ask three times. Yeah. Third time you get your way. So the third time, the Buddha had to relent. And so these are interesting instructions. So remember, the Buddha didn't have a lot of time. So he's just trying to give pith instructions that will lead to awakening. So very interesting. So he said, "This is how you should practice, Bahia. This is what you need to notice. In the seen is just the seen. In the heard, in the hearing is just hearing. In the tasting is just tasting. In the smelling is just smelling. In the thinking is just thinking. If you train yourself thus, Bahia, you'll begin to notice that there's no me or mine or I in this experience. And when your mind comes to see that, the mind will become free." That's all you need to do, Bahia. That's the heart of the instructions here. And shortly after that, Bahia was awakened, had some kind of awakening experience. The practice of the five aggregates in some ways is that simple. It's just seeing experience for what it is. And that begins to break through the sense of self. That's good because Bahia, if you know Bahia, what happened to him? Gore is unbelievable. So after he met the Buddha, it was shortly thereafter he actually got gored by a cow and died. So he came to awakening in the right amount of time. So may we all attain some level of awakening before that cow comes. Thank you.